No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will help you shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And tonight we have a special guest. We usually have politicians, governors, senators, congressmen, but tonight we have Parrish Smith, and he is a producer, director, choreographer, writer, seems to be a jack of all trades, a real Renaissance man, and he's done over 50 short films that have been seen on major networks across this country and the world, and most recently, he's done a film called, I'm going to ask him to tell you all about the film, but it's about four stand-up comedians from the District of Columbia. So let's get started. Parrish, welcome to the show.
Senator Brown, thank you for having me. That's a great intro, by the way. Thank you for that.
But we're so happy to have you. And like I say, we're so interested. My mother her passion in life was theater. So I've been, a kid that used to go to the movies when I was just a small kid with my brother and watch double matinees on Saturday, and have been addicted to TV, film, and every kind of theater you can imagine since I was a little boy. So I'm really intrigued to have somebody like you on the show. Let me start by telling us about Mecca of Comedy. Tell us about this film that you've just done.
Well, the Mecca of Comedy is a documentary about the history and rich legacy of Black comedians from Washington, D.C. So it kind of stretches from the 70s into the 80s, of when many of these comedians were raised. So it's like Wanda Sykes is in the film, Martin Lawrence, Donnell Rawlings, Abby Evans, Red Grant, Joe Claire, Tommy Davidson from A Living Color. It's kind of a who's who. It chronicles Black comedians, not just the comedians. It kind of also tells the comedy scene of how stand-up comedy as it pertains to African-Americans within the district and the DMV as a whole, how it kind of came about. So it goes into comedy clubs, from Garvin's Comedy Club, which is the premier comedy club in Washington, D.C. The Comedy Cafe was another one. Ibex, Mr. Henry's, the Comedy Connection. So it's just, it's just a great summary of many of the pioneers, trailblazers within comedy who are from the DMV area, which many people may not know, that many of these comedians were mentors, teachers to Wanda Sykes, Martin Lawrence, Dave Chappelle, Tommy Davidson. And they're still here. They still live here in D.C., not the actual comedians, but the comedians who were mentors and teachers to the bigger names who we now know. But Washington, D.C., just doesn't just breed successful comedians or famous comedians, but it also has successful comedians. So many comedians from Washington, D.C. may not have the big name, but they work every weekend, almost every other day, within comedy clubs, they tour the country, they even tour the world. So, D.C. pales in size to New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles. However, it produces probably many more comedians than the bigger cities out there. So it's history, it's culture, it's comedy, and it's humor, all kind of wrapped up into one.
Well, you think there's something peculiar about Washington, D.C.? I mean, we produce a lot of misery around the country generally, right? And people's perception of us as Congress goes forth fighting like children, as they did last week. Is there something that, what generates this? Am I wrong that when I was young, now I'm 70 years old, but when I was young, there were very few black stand-up comedians. Is that not true? Is there not many more of them today than there used to be?
Oh, there are a lot more now.
Yeah.
You know, back in the early, yeah, Moms Mabley, when it comes to African-American, she was one. I think, you know, most people, you know, can think of Red Fox, Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy.
Right. Yeah.
You know, comedians, even Bill Cosby, you know, they were some of the pioneers of you know, of comedians who kind of like hit it big back in the 50s and the 60s. But it was a much harder time back then.
Yes.
You know, you had, you know, trying to get a room when you were a black stand-up comedian, it was very difficult. You had to deal with
racism,
discrimination. You know, if they gave you time at a comedy club, it might be 5 minutes. You were often not the headliner at the comedy club.
Right.
You couldn't play certain rooms. Because it might be in a sundown town if you were in the South. And if you were a black female comedian, then you have to deal with sexism at the same time. So nowadays, there are a lot of comedians. And they don't really have to quite deal with what the pioneers had to deal with, you know, during the civil rights era. However, there might be too many comedians nowadays. There might be, you know, and there might be so many that sometimes some of the great ones kind of get drowned out there who really have something to say and who are really prolific in their material, you know, their set when they go on stage. I've always been a fan of comedy. You know, comedy is medicine.
Yes,
and
it is.
You know, and it's medicine. And, you know, I just read recently that, you know, one of therapy for people who have a high stressful job or who have a heart condition is laughter. It reduces your stress. It reduces some hormone levels. So, you know, comedy has always been around, and everyone needs to go out to a comedy club every now and then or watch one on Netflix or Amazon Prime. You know, it's necessary and it's needed. And, you know, I can't stress enough that, you know, this film really kind of just digs into not just humor. You know, many comedians kind of come from pain, right? And they come from, they've come up and they've lived a hard life and they kind of turn that agony into humor. And it's no different than Red Fox, Richard Pryor. If you watch a lot of Richard Pryor's, a lot of his stadium shows that he had like live on the Sunset Strip, like, you know, you can hear it in his, hear in his voice. Even George Carlin is another one. You know, these are just, you know. And so the ones in this film are the same. They've kind of come up a little hard, especially when they were trying to break through that color barrier into comedy. And so they turn a lot of it into humor, which helps make you laugh a little bit more at what you're going through in life.
Right. Well, you know, I'm not sure that people can have a real sense of what this was like if people like you don't do films, documentaries about it. We all know about The Green Book, for example, but I just learned there's a new show on Broadway called Suff, and about the suffragist movement. And I just learned that when A.J. Dion came from the South to stand up and walk down Pennsylvania Avenue with the suffragists because she was black and she led black women, Alice Paul asked her to walk in the back of the group, told her to wait her turn and not imagine that you brought all these black women to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue and you've been asked to get on the back of the bus by the person that organized the whole thing. I don't think we can have a true appreciation of how hard that must have been. So thanks for people like you bringing it forward. And isn't that pain that these people felt that drives them to this, isn't that what makes them relatable as comics, right? We all, when Red Fox tells some joke about his wife or his boss or his family or you know, some hard time he's had, we can all relate to it somehow. And that's really what makes us laugh, is it not?
It is. You know, any great comedian can take something that has been tragic to them or just an everyday occurrence and turn it into humor. And when it comes to Black folks in particular, we've always had to turn our pain into funny. That's kind of how we coped throughout history.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can take, you know, Flip Wilson as a, you know, prime example, Dick Gregory, you know, I mentioned Miles Mabley, but these are comedians who just have taken the hardships in life and turned it into some type of comedic enjoyment for themselves and also for others. But, you know, nonetheless, though, sometimes they're still struggling. But the magic in humor is that's exactly what it is. It's a gift that you can make someone laugh even when what you have gone through is just totally horrific. Dick Gregory was always one of my favorite, comedians. He was an activist. I mean, he passed away a few years ago, but he marched with Dr. King. He was a friend of Malcolm X. And so, you know, and his career, he could have had a much larger career, a more lucrative career, if he hadn't, you know, turned more to activism. That kind of hurt his career, in a way. And that, even that's tragic. But all of what he was going through at that time, he turned it into some type of enjoyment for others. And that's what comedy is all about, you know. Comedians work magic on stage. It's very hard. I don't think people realize it's very hard to get up on stage, hold a microphone, and kind of speak their truth as to what's going on in their life or what they see, you know, in the news, for other people to enjoy. And then not just to speak truth, but to speak truth nowadays in the face of cancel culture. Cancel culture, it happens. If you just say the wrong thing nowadays, you could be canceled immediately. And your career, if it was once thriving, could now kind of be on the ropes. And I've even had comedians tell me that, you know, they were asked not to speak about, you know, the Trump administration, or President Trump, you know, specifically, because they won't be asked to come back to that club the following week. So, you know, if you tell LGBTQ jokes nowadays, that can potentially cancel you. If you talk about the war in Israel, you know, the Hamas and Israel war, that can potentially cancel you. But comedy and comedians have always been line steppers, right? I think their job has always been to kind of push the boundaries and bring up issues of what's going on, but to do it through humor, not to do it in a malicious fashion, but to add humor to the situation. That's what makes it comical, and that's what makes it kind of, you know, it transcends what's going on. So I've always had a great admiration for comedians for that reason.
Me too. And don't get me started about Dick Gregory. He was a mentor of mine. After he died on his first birthday, we got together with his family and held a birthday party for him, birthday celebration for him. Just an amazing man, an amazing example to all of us of a life well lived, right? We all know the incident with Jack Parr, where he refused to go on the show if he didn't get to sit on the couch. And that opened doors. It opened a lot of doors. And I've never heard a Black comedian that didn't thank him for his activism. You know, I think they all realize that. But comedy really does help us evolve socially, doesn't it? I watch old reruns from time to time. I'll come across an All in the Family. Now, I'm not even sure if you could show that show today, given how politically incorrect it was, but it made us take a redneck, right? And we all laughed at him. We all laughed at what a buffoon Archie Bunker was. He was a lovable buffoon somehow, but we all realized that how wrong he was in his view of the world. So didn't that push us in a more positive direction. Isn't that what comedy does all the time? Don't they break down barriers all the time? And when you talk about things that you're allowed to talk about and not talk about, of course, we had a big controversy here with Dave Chappelle, which I'm sure you realize. He's one of our favorite sons. He graduated from Duke Ellington, which is our school for the arts here in Washington. He was invited back to be a speaker. He made some LGBT joke, and the students got together and decided they didn't want him on. Dave stood his ground, refused to apologize for being somebody that pushed the boundaries, and in the end, I can't remember if they relented and let him speak or not, but it was somewhat of a tempest in a teapot, I would call it. I wouldn't call it a real controversy. It took up the front page of the Metro section for a day or two. That's got to be a continuing problem for him. But it seems like guys like Dave Chappelle don't back off. Is he another, you think he's another Dick Gregory in the making?
I'm not quite sure if he's a Dick Gregory in the making. Dick went a little deeper because of the civil rights movement and activism. Willing to kind of give all of it up, for that. However, Chappelle is highly astute. He is very intelligent when it comes to comedy, and also just as a person. And if you talk to him, you would kind of grasp that. Even in his comedy, he's also very astute, very very aware as to what's going on. Now, whether you agree with the closer, which is what you're referring to, with the LGBTQ jokes, mm-hmm. or not, it was still very clever. I'm not sure if everyone who watches his comedy and his comedy shows agrees with all his jokes. They may laugh here and there, but I still think people admire his cleverness when it comes to humor. Now, one link that you can kind of draw a comparison between Dick Gregory and Chappelle is that when Chappelle was at the height of his career on Comedy Central with the Chappelle Show, he walked away from a big contract, which was millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And he chose to because he thought his humor, people who were non-black essentially were laughing at him, and he kind of realized that maybe his humor that he was giving off wasn't maybe the best for African Americans, and so when they were going to give him another big contract, he stepped away. And lost a lot of money. And that takes balls to do because everyone just can't turn down millions of dollars at the height of their career. In a way, that's kind of Dick Gregory-ish, being able to turn down that kind of money. And yet, years later, Chappelle came back and was able to bounce back and kind of get back into his career when he could have lost a lot, based on what he thought was perceived to be a bad move on the Chappelle Show. But he's highly astute and he's very intellectual. Going back to Archie Bunker, because you mentioned All in the Family. Now, I was raised in the I was born in 1974, so I was pretty much raised in the 80s, in late 70s. But my father, and mother, they watched All in the Family, just like they watched The Jeffersons and they watched Good uh-huh. Times. So I'm very, they watch the, the Red Fox. What's the, his show as well. Sanford and Son, exactly. So yeah. I'm very familiar with Archie Bunker. He was a racist. He was a sexist, but people didn't like him. He was a likable character on the show.
Right.
And people, and black folks in particular, they watched the show. They may not have like all of what Archie Bunker said, but they did watch the show. Now, you can't play that show nowadays because there are certain words and languages that you just can't use.
Right.
And rightfully so. I understand that.
Right.
But
me too.
But, but the thing about a comedian and when it comes to in comedy, I think you can say almost anything you want to say, but It has to be a way that is relevant and that there's humor in it. Otherwise, it's just malicious. And it's meaning is cruel. So there has to be a way that you can kind of infuse that humor into it so that people can enjoy it. You just can't be, kind of come on stage and be a comic and just kind of rant and just and be divisive, in your content. That's the difference. And Archie Bunker, if it's on now, I may still sit down and watch and may laugh, laugh here and there, just like I do, a lot of the shows that came out during that time. And I love Sanford and Son. It was one of my favorite shows of all time. So, I totally get it. But Dave Chappelle is one of our, he's one of Washington, D.C.'s top comedians of all time. I mean, he has to be. He might be a GOAT, the greatest of all time, or one of the greatest of all time comedians out there. And he is a product of Washington, D.C. I know he's raised in Maryland, but, he was raised in the comedy clubs as a kid. And I think at like 14 or 15, he started playing comedy clubs. His mother would come to the club with him and sit in the back because he couldn't drive himself home afterwards. And wow. a lot of the comedians who were in a documentary in the Mecca of comedy, such as Tony Woods, who is Dave Chappelle's mentor, would often drive Dave Chappelle home after he finished, his routine if his mother wasn't around. Many other comedians, such as Andy Evans, who was a godfather of Washington D.C. comedy, would drive him home. The fat doctor, his real name was Darcell Blagman, was the mentor of Martin Lawrence. People probably haven't even heard of the fat doctor, but the fat doctor, you never would have even heard of Martin Lawrence for sure, probably if it were not for the fat doctor. He saw Martin Lawrence, who was young at the time, his material. When I say material, I mean his jokes, his writing wasn't the best. So he helped Martin Lawrence. He taught him how to structure a joke, tell a joke, the timing in the joke, how to have a callback. A callback just means that if you mention a topic maybe at the front or in the beginning of your set, you bring it back at the end of your set or somewhere in the middle of your set that kind of ties into what you're talking about. So you call the joke back up. These are all comedic elements that comedians use. And so he was able to teach Martin Lawrence all these elements to make him a much better stand-up so that when he left D.C., he would be a stronger comedian. And I don't know if you remember, but Martin Lawrence was on Star Search. And yeah. I think he won the first round, maybe the second round or two, but then he lost the third round or so. So, and then from there, he went on Def Comedy Jam. He had some roles on What's Happening Now, and some other ones. But he too is one of Washington, D.C.'s, greatest comedians of all time. And so, those are just examples of two right there. Then you have Wanda Sykes, who, was from D.C. She's from Anne Arundel County, but it's still kind of within the DMV area.
Yeah.
And so, and most people don't even know that Wanda Sykes is from Washington, D.C. or from the area. They thought she was from some other city. I don't think people know the abundance of talent that's from here. And then you have Tommy Davidson, who is in A Living Color. He's from the Bethesda Chevy Chase area. He actually went to Bethesda Chevy Chase High School. Then you have Earthquake, who another great comedian who is from Southeast D.C. He kind of got started more so in Atlanta, but he was raised in Southeast D.C. So, and those are five comedians who are, probably the most famous, but there are a lot way more successful ones and also ones who have reached a good amount of fame from D.C. And I can even talk about Red Grant. I'm sure you probably have heard of being in politics. Red Grant ran for mayor of Washington, D.C. as an independent. Rodney Red Grant is his full name. And now he's running for, I believe, councilman at large for D.C. So, there's just so many of them. Originally, the documentary was named More Than Comedy. right? It wasn't, at first, it wasn't, the name of it was not the Mecca of Comedy. It was called More Than Comedy. And the title was because so many comedians from Washington, D.C. have gone on to do bigger and better things other than comedy, or they use comedy as their foundation. And then they've launched into other endeavors, such as Rodney Red Grant into politics, Joe Claire, who's currently on Fox 5, D.C., but he was also on WPGC on the radio. Before that, he was on on BET's Rap City. You have Tony Perkins, who I don't think people know. You know Tony Perkins from NBC4. He's a journalist, but he was also on Good Morning America. But Tony Perkins was a comedian. He started as a comedian in Washington, D.C. He played Garvin's Comedy Club. And then he met Donnie Simpson. He's on the radio also. But he used comedy. Everything that he's pretty much done in his career, comedy has kind of played a part. When he's on the air, when he's talking, you can hear the timing and his comedic ability as he's talking. And that has helped him within journalism. And so you have people who have gone to be writers and authors, producers, actors, et cetera. So it was always that Washington, D.C. just wasn't comedy, but these comedians ran deeper. You had more depth into who they were and more in their background. I'm not saying that other cities don't have that, but Washington, D.C. was just a little different. You know, of course, we know New York City with Eddie Murphy, Chris Rock, the Wayans, there's a whole lot of them. But Washington, D.C. is a little different, right? Washington, D.C. was the first chocolate city. In 1970, it was 71.1% African-American. 1957, it became the first majority black city within the country, which is major, right? It was the capital of black America. You had the Mecca just means the center. So when I say the Mecca, I'm referring to Washington D.C. as the center for black academia when it comes to Howard University. I'm a graduate of Howard University, and a lot of professors and academics, I'm talking about black academics, are graduates of Howard University. It was the center for black activism with Stokely Carmichael, people know him as Kwame Ture, black culture, go-go music, arts and poetry, et cetera. You had Marvin Gaye, you had Roberta Flack in Washington, D.C. And then you had arts and entertainment. You mentioned before, Senator Brown, that, D.C. kind of gets a bad rap. And it does because of politics.
Yeah.
But beyond politics, D.C. has always been an arts and entertainment town. You go back to Black Broadway, which was the U Street corridor.
Right.
This was a major attraction or center for arts and entertainment. You had Pearl Bailey would come down here and do shows. And the reason why it was even called Black Broadway was because of Pearl Bailey. She named it herself. She named it Black Broadway. You had Howard Theater. Howard Theater was around before the Apollo Theater was even built. And acts all around the country would come and play at the Howard Theater. U Street, you even had beauty pageants and parades on U Street. This wasn't just for arts and entertainment, but it was also like a black Wall Street, like similar to Tulsa, Oklahoma. There were black-owned businesses along the corridor, hotels and restaurants and florist shops and banks, et cetera. And when people would come into town, they would stay on U Street. So it just wasn't, it was much more than that. This was the same chocolate city that one of the greatest bands of all time, Parliament Funkadelic, named their third album Chocolate City because of Washington, D.C. They loved Washington, D.C. so much, and they beloved it, and they admired it, that they named their third album Chocolate City. And if you see the cover, it's bronze, and it has different monuments from Washington, D.C. on the cover, but it's a bronze cover. So these comedians come from this era. And I'm talking about Andy Evans and Greg Cooper. I'll go on Greg Cooper in a second. Judge Poole and Sylvia Trayvon Morrison, who was the first black female writer on SNL. These are the ones who are mentors to Dave Chappelle and Martin Lawrence and Tommy Davidson and Wanda Sykes. These are the ones who came from this era of Washington, D.C. That's why I say it's the mecca of comedy, because besides New York City and Chicago and even Los Angeles, they didn't have what Washington, D.C. had, which is the history of what made D.C. the mecca of comedy, or just the mecca itself. Even the public school system. You had M Street School, which is, Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School, which is which graduates, if I'm talking too much, just let me know too, Sanchez. But which graduated the most black students within the country. It had a robust public school system. And these comedians come from this public school system generation. So there's just so much rich history when it comes to Washington, D.C. And this is why I say it's the mecca of comedy, because these comedians are conscious, they're sophisticated, they're smart. And when they go on stage and they perform, the audience is just that. They're the same. Keep in mind that D.C. at one time had a large, affluent black middle class. And PG County is still the largest county, affluent county in the country's African American. So when they come sit down into a club or a theater and a comedian is on stage, it's hard. You can't really kind of bluff your way through. You have to bring substance in your comedy, because the people sitting in front of you are no dummies. They are smart too, and they are aware of what's going on. And so you have to kind of just bring more of the jokes than your everyday content of what you hear out there. You have to dig deeper into your arsenal of jokes when you perform in D.C.
Well, it's true that, first of all, we do have a bad image because people see the politics, but they don't see our local community. You mentioned Mr. Henry's earlier. When I was in high school, we used to go to Mr. Henry's on Capitol Hill and watch Roberta Flack. I mean, she was a regular there. It used to blow us away that more people didn't know about that, because it was just wonderful. And of course, there are so many others, from Duke Ellington we could go on and on and on about all the people that have come out. But one thing I want to say about All in the Family, too, that I think is true of Norman Lear and the stuff that he did, is he allowed black people to be black people. To be real. The Jeffersons were real. They weren't Chuck and Jive. They weren't Amos and Andy. They didn't, when they got insulted by Archie Bunker, they didn't take it. They gave it back, right? They were allowed to be stand up. They were allowed to be real characters. So I think and that was its saving grace that kind of moved us forward. But you're right. It would be hard to show that show today, wouldn't it? But let me ask you this. Because I think you're right. I think many of these talents are connected. And Tony Perkins was a local guy that we all loved. He was on the news here locally before he went national, and then he came back. Mm-hmm. But many of these skills are the same skills that politicians use, are they not? I mean, I have a daughter who does improv with Second City Theater in Chicago. And she's also very politically, she won't get involved in politics, but she has great political opinions. And I say to her, I say, man, you already got 90% of it down. If you can stand in front of an audience and speak extemporaneously, I said, that's half of being a politician right there. Right. So this was good training for him, was it not, to be here and to see these people? They're really not that much different, right? They're trying to reach you. They're trying to make you think about something. What usually, if it's a politician, usually it's about them. But it's the same, pretty much the same motivation, isn't it? I mean, a really good politician would probably also be a really good stand-up comic if he set his mind to it, I think. Unfortunately, they are often too, stand-up comedians when they're not meant to be. But yeah, it must have been good training for them, because you can't escape politics in Washington. If you're in the school system, right, the marches are going on in our city. We were here with the Million Man March on Washington. We were here in 1968 with the riots. We were here with the Dr. King's March on Washington. So it's hard to ignore it. And we've also been ground zero for the civil rights movement in many ways, right? Brown versus Board of Education was a case that involved a DC public school kid. You know, the March on Washington. You know, you could go on and on and on about all the civil rights things, from the suffragist movement to the equal rights movement here in America that all took place here. And so it's a great place to create stand-up comedians, right? Because they go out in the world, and that's what people relate to. They really, you know, I think they're so much more relatable. And that's the most important thing you could say as a politician. Take it from a guy that's been reelected three times. The most powerful thing you can say to somebody is, I'm like you, you know? If I go before a bunch of working people, the first thing I say is I was a Teamster. Because that means I'm a member of your club. You know, and that's what comedians have to do too, right? They have to say, I'm you. I understand where you're coming from, and this is where I'm coming from, right? Isn't that right?
Yeah, it has to relate. I think any great orator, someone who can stand in front of someone and give a speech, a sermon, a lecture, a set, which is what a comedian does. They kind of give their set. It's all relatable. And if you can add humor to it, then it just goes a long way. But the thread to it is that everyone has to have something to say, and it has to be relatable to the person who is in the audience looking at you. If not, you will lose the person. So it doesn't matter if you're a politician, if you're a preacher, if you or a lecturer, if you just kind of give them a speech in front of a PTA meeting, you know, something like that. You have to be able to relate with the person sitting in front of you, or else it's lost. And that's the same for a comedian. I think that's how you get your laughs. People laugh at your jokes because they can relate to what you're saying. It could be something very simplistic, as, you know, going grocery shopping or washing clothes or what have you. But everyone has done that. I remember there was a joke that Sinbad gave, and he said, like, when he would go to McDonald's, you know, everyone knows the menu at McDonald's, right? People have been to McDonald's at least once or twice, 10 times in a lifetime. By now, you already know what you want. But every time you would go, people would be standing in front of them, staring at the menu as if it's their first time there. And he's like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, you have to, like, no one does that. Everyone knows what they want at McDonald's or Chick-fil-A, whatever, because they've been there. But people can relate to that. That's why people laugh. That's why people laugh. It's because of that reason. And if you're a politician, you know, people want to relate to what you're saying. They want to know, you know, how can you bring down taxes, make my city safer? Because, you know, if you're living in a city that's unsafe, that's what you relate to. That's what you kind of hold on to. That's what comedy is all about. And so if you watch a Norma Lear show, a sitcom, that's part of it too. And you're right.
Right. That's right.
So, you know, the black actors on the shows didn't take any mess. Like, you know, George Jefferson would give it back to you. If you gave him attitude, he would give it right back to you. And then he would give it back to you two or three times harder than what you gave it to him. Right. You know, and that's what they were stand-up characters. And that's one of the reasons why I like George Jefferson. And Stanford and Sunday as well, for those reasons. You know, in the documentary, P.D. Green is in there as well. And, you know, there was a movie made about P.D. Green that Don Cheadle played in the movie. And we know P.D. Green as being a radio host here in D.C. And he spoke his mind, right? But people, when Petey Green passed away, I was told, because I wasn't here, but I was told that it was the largest funeral procession in D.C. But the reason why that is because people could relate to what Petey Green had to say. He was one of the people. He would speak his mind, and he used humor oftentimes to relate to it, but people, you know, people loved what he had to say, and they trusted him what he had to say. And trust is that also goes a long way, too. That could be a whole other conversation about trust when it comes to comedians, when it comes to politicians, et cetera. But people love Petey Green for that reason. You know, he would speak the truth, and he would speak truth to power.
Right, and I think that's what we admired, that was his bravery. And another one of my mentors, Joe Madison, kind of, you know, he wasn't Petey Green, but he was certainly in that mold where he spoke truth to power. And you know, Petey Green, yeah, everybody in Washington knew who he was. Everybody, whether you agreed with him or not, respected him for what he did. And, yeah, I'm not the least bit surprised that his was the largest funeral procession. Really not. He was an amazing character. So does comedy evolve? I've got to tell you, one of the things that made me laugh most that Dave Chappelle has done is the thing he does about the Klansman. Now, I thought to myself, I really can't talk about this on my show, can I? Because it's really, really controversial. I mean, it's really controversial, but it's comedy genius. I mean, it's brilliant. Whoever thought of, you know, the Smothers Brothers actually did a similar thing, and they were banned from the air. Do you remember that? They had a thing where there were two Ku Klux Klan members that fell in love with each other, and when they took off their sheets, one of them was black and one of them was white, and that ended their show. That single move back then ended their show. So as we become more tolerant, I mean, I don't know that that's the right word, but then comedy changes along with that, or what? It's a chicken or egg thing, right? What comes first, the comedy or the change?
I think the change comes. The change comes first, and then the comedy. But you mentioned Joe Madison, but the Black Eagle.
Yeah,
I listened to Joe Madison for a long time on Urban View, and I listened to him. I knew of him even before then. He was, you know, may he rest in peace on his transition. Yes. I do miss him on the airwaves. He was a voice. Yeah,
me too.
Who spoke truth to power, and he spoke his mind. Which is what I liked about him so much. And, you know, I can't say enough about, you know, he was just a pioneer, you know, on the radio. So I just, you know, my hat's off to the Black Eagle. But I think change has to come first and then the comedy. You know, comedians just kind of, they come up with material based on what's going on. And I guess you could ask yourself the question, can comedy, if comedians kind of, you know, speak on certain matters and subjects, which will change happen? And that's very well possible, right? It's no different than if an activist talks about a situation, can change come about? I think it can. And comedians can also be change agents at the same time. I think what makes a comedian transcendent is that they can go deep on the topic. You know, there comes a point when a comedian can do a concert show or a special, and it's not always funny, because they kind of go into topics that aren't always funny, but they have something to say. And their voice, and because they have a voice and a platform, they use their comedy special to say it. And it could be entertaining, but not quite funny. And only a few comedians reach that level. But what happens is that now you have people the next day talking about what the comedian said, such as a Dick Gregory, even a Dave Chappelle, even a Chris Rock, a George Carlin. You know, they come out and they speak it, and then it becomes conversation for the next week or 2 weeks, and it makes people think a different way about something. And that's what you want when you come out of a comedy show. Not just a comedy show. If you come out of church, if you come out of any type of event where there's a speaker, even a politician, you want to be able to think differently about what that person said. That's the overall purpose. The joke is one thing, but it's to make you think differently. And maybe you might even change your way of thinking based on what that comedian has said. And that right there is really what comedy is. Even Jerry Seinfeld is another one. Like, you know, you hear him, you're on my stage and he's talking, and, you know, his is more situational comedy, but even still, you may think differently about what just transpired. And that's the brilliance of comedy. There's another comedian in the documentary, The Mecca of Comedy, named Greg Cooper. Greg Cooper is the first black comedian to play The Tonight Show from D.C., to play The Tonight Show, I think in 1982 or 83. And he was just, you know, he was just playing local clubs here in Washington, D.C., and he was at Howard one night doing his comedy routine. And Bill Cosby was in the audience. Now, I don't know if you know, I'm sure you know, but Bill Cosby was a big comedian back then. He was a major comedian.
Oh, yeah.
He was huge. And, yeah, you know, in light of what happened recently, you know, with all the, you know, what's going on with him, back then he was a major comedian. So he discovered Greg Cooper doing a routine, and he invited Greg Cooper to come on the Tonight Show. He was the first comedian from Washington, D.C., black comedian, to play on The Tonight Show. Now, Johnny Carson wasn't there that night. So, you know, Bill Cosby was a host that evening. And he brought him on, and Greg Cooper just went on and did his routine. And he does impersonations. He would do Howard Cosell. He would do Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali. And he was fantastic. And he had a phenomenal set on The Tonight Show. And that's just another comedian. Then from there, his career didn't quite evolve as it should have. It kind of, you know, but that was one of the highlights of his career. And that kind of like gave him, you know, credit to move on and do, you know, other endeavors. But when you talk about comedians who are brilliant and kind of just, you know, are change agents, Washington, D.C. comedians are right there in the forefront. They're right there, and they just make you question sometimes what's going on in your life and, you know, in everything around you. That's just the brilliance when it comes to comedy, and in particular Washington, D.C. comedians, you know.
Well, and you know what? When you talk about Bill Cosby, now this is before your time, Paris, but when I was a kid, we used to sit around. This is what we did on Saturday night because there were only four TV channels. My kids would be appalled at that, but there were only four TV channels. We used to listen to Bill Cosby albums. I still remember his routine about Noah building the ark and some of the other, right? That they were hysterical. And we still, you know, and I read his book. Somebody gave me his book when I became a parent because he had a lot of children. And he wrote a book about children, which is hysterical because it really relates to kids. And it's unfortunate what happened in his life. Yeah, sure. But doesn't that parallel what happens with politicians? Are politicians found in the same situation so many times? I agree. You have to be able to relate to people, and that makes a difference. You know, my mom was a wonderful, wonderful person, but she was a bigot. She believed every stereotype about every group in you know, about black people, Irish people, Jewish people. But she worked in an all-black school, and the black children loved her, and she loved the black children. And I never understood that. I used to fight with her, and I would say, Mom, what do you think happens when these kids grow up? They change? No, they're the same people. But the difference I realized when I got older is when she looked at him in school, she saw children. Mm. When she looked at him out on the street, she saw something else. And she was afraid, and she didn't understand, and she didn't relate to them. So she didn't know how to act with black people. Mm. She was more afraid of black people than anything else. But at school, they were children. Mm. So that's it. You have to see people as people, right? Because if you see him as something else, then you can vilify him, you can objectify them, you can treat them differently. But if you see them as your neighbors and people that live in your community and people that add significantly to the fabric of what America is, which they certainly are, you know, today Joe Biden said Black history is American history, and it certainly is. In fact, some of Black history predates American history in this country. So we're about to run out of time here, so I want to ask you, what do you want to say that you haven't said? Is there anything you want us to add? Because we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left.
Real quick, I didn't know. I saw that you were born in Newark, New Jersey. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, I was raised in Newark, New Jersey. I'm from Newark, New Jersey. I was raised there. Yeah, the Velsburg, you know, the Velsburg section of New Jersey. My link to D.C. is Howard University. And so that's how I got down here in D.C.
My mom was a teacher in the public school system. And we moved down here because she got a job down here in the school system. But Newark was an interesting place to grow up, and it was a real lesson. And when I was young, now it was probably different when you were growing up, but when I was growing up, the city was being torn apart by racial problems, torn apart.
Yeah. After the riot, I was born after the riots.
Yeah, every business moved out of Newark, Ballantine Beer, the Newark Evening News, all the big employers moved out because of the racial problems and moved to other places in New Jersey that were cheaper and more stable. And that only added to the problem, you know, with higher unemployment. It was a real problem area. But you know what? It taught me a great lesson. I lived in a city that was majority Black for the most part. Newark was when I was a kid. And I never saw a Black teacher, never saw a Black police officer. There were no Black people in my neighborhood. You know, we were totally segregated. And Washington, when I moved to Washington, it was such a richer, more vibrant community. And you know, and as a teenager, right, the first thing you see is the hypocrisy in everything. The hypocrisy in what went on in Newark really stuck out to me as a sort of, I mean, maybe that's where the roots of my activism come from.
Sure.
But I've met a lot of cool people from Newark. Paris, yeah. I'll put your name on the list as well, because it was an interesting place to grow up. And, you know, none of us aspired to come to Washington, D.C. We all aspired to live in Manhattan.
Right. Yeah,
that was a dream, right, in North New Jersey. Someday I'm going to move to Manhattan, and I'm going to live large like a New Yorker. But Paris Smith, it's great success. I hope you have great success with your film. I want you to know that I'm about to retire in January, so I'm available for your film on DC statehood when you decide to do that. I'm ready for my close up, Mr. DeMille. Well, I don't know if I'm ready, but I'd love to have. Great to have you on my show. You're welcome back anytime. I hope you have more new, exciting projects in the future, and I wish you continued success. It's really an honor to have you. We're honored to count you among the many great graduates, including our vice president of Howard University, a great school that cares deeply about what I do, and I care deeply about them. So thanks for being on the show. I wish you continued success, and we hope to hear from you again.
Absolutely. The film, just so you know, the film is available on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, and Tubi. Amazon Prime, Apple TV, and Tubi. And thank you so much for having me on your show. This hour flew by. It went by so fast. And it was a great conversation. great.
Yeah, that's the way I feel too. Thank you. And I know what I'm going to watch on Apple TV tonight. Okay, so thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. And here we put out a song every week to in honor of our guests. And this goes out not only to you, but to Wanda, Martin, Dave, and Tommy. Here's the late, well, he's not the, oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to kill him off. He's not, he's in his 80s. But here's Smokey Robinson with Tears of a Clown. Thanks.
Give the people their right to vote.